Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smita Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another edition of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm a sex med gynecologist and menopause expert in downtown Chicago. Today, I'm super excited. This has been like 9 months in the making. my amazing colleague and friend, Dr. Amy Bodish. She is a Stanford gynecologist, menopause expert, co-host of the popular podcast, Overreactive.
I know, it's a tongue twister.
And co-authoring an upcoming book called Estrogen Interrupted. We're going to dive into stages, one of the most misunderstood stages in women's health and life, and that's perimenopause. And we're going to talk about why it seems like our bodies have suddenly just left the chat and trying to figure out what to do with it. Why so many people are told they're too young for hormonal changes, what evidence-based medicine should look like, and really hormone symptom management in this period, and all the good things. So thank you, Amy, for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting. I'll talk about anything having to do with perimenopause and menopause till the cows come home. So this is like my most fun morning ever. Agreed. Thank you.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, so I'm Gyno Girl. I love a good backstory. So tell me what your backstory is. What brought you into women's health, OBGYN, and then how'd you land into this space? Because, you know, there's not a track to get into perimenopause, menopause yet.
I know, right?
It's all something we do independently because we want to learn something we were never taught. So
that exactly. I mean, we really are self-taught apprentices. I mean, you know, that's exactly right. If you're not lucky enough to have a mentor in your current practice setting, you have to go find it. This is not something that is handed. There's no sort of set pathway to get to where we are. So
in your training, I always ask people, like, do you remember what you, like, was there a lecture? Was there a person?
We had maybe a lecture or two every other year. So we had a 4-year residency program, and then the curriculum sort of followed like a I went to medical school at the Mayo Clinic in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota. Okay. And I'm from Minnesota. So I'm very proud of my state.
Yeah.
And then I went out to California and I did residency at Kaiser Santa Clara, which is a community-based program.
It's wonderful.
And incredible training and just sort of like the bread and butter of OBGYN. It was great. Yeah. My clinical training is so strong. But just like most OBGYN programs, there was very little on menopause. And we had one attending, Dr. Catherine Brubaker, who has since retired and is enjoying her fabulous life, who was really passionate about it. And she would give these lectures and she kind of came every other year. So maybe total out of 4 years of residency, I had about 4 hours of someone talking about menopause and perimenopause. But our lecture time, I know at least 2 of those hours, I was post-call, which meant I'd been up all night. And then I was sitting during the lectures and I literally, you just want to die because you're so tired. Yep, so probably I personally had about 2 hours of actual listening and paying attention to anything dealing with menopause. And mostly we just talked about the WHI study because this was in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the information that we had at the time was at that point, like hormone replacement therapy wasn't considered safe, really.
Right.
So that was sort of the messaging that you got, right? You're like, well, you just got to tough it out. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
And then I went on and I did a complex family planning fellowship at Stanford. So I became an expert in abortion and contraception. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, well, how did that lead you to perimenopause and menopause? Yeah. And there's just like a really beautiful transition because with complex family planning, we're talking about contraception. We're talking about preventing unplanned pregnancies in patients either because it's not a good time for them to be pregnant or because maybe they have pretty complex medical problems and really shouldn't get pregnant.
Yeah.
And then, so I had all these patients and then they were getting older and they needed contraception, but then they were having all these perimenopausal symptoms.
Yes.
And it's like this perfect blend of you still have to meet their contraceptive need and treat what's happening with their perimenopause, which is kind of a weird, it's like a kind of a weird time.
Yeah.
Because they're not thinking about getting pregnant, but they need to be thinking about that's actually still a real issue, but they're much more concerned.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You're like, I don't want to get, I'm 48. I don't want to get pregnant, but it's not on my radar. I'm like, well, it's still on your ovaries radar. Yeah, so exactly. They're still thinking about it. So it's just kind of an interesting, so those became my favorite patients because I got to use my complex family planning brain, but then I became really interested in the puzzle of perimenopause and menopause and how do we help people? Because so many people come into your office, you and I were talking offline beforehand, and this practice sort of generates itself and you're going, I don't know. These people come to see you and you're like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
And then you realize, okay, I got to dig deep. Like I got to figure this out because this is so unsatisfying for everybody. We didn't become doctors to be like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you like want to meet their needs and you want patients to feel better. And I didn't have the skill set to do that. Not for lack of trying by, you know, poor Dr. Brubaker, who was doing her best with the 2 hours she was allotted, you know, every 2 years. But that wasn't enough to make it happen. So I had to teach myself, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, we like to practice evidence-based medicine, but that does include your own clinical. That includes not only the, you know, the clinical guidelines and data and whatever, but also your own clinical experiences and expertise, which you can't get until you start seeing the patients. But, you know, it's like this weird, like, roundabout thing. Like, okay, I can't really do evidence-based medicine because I don't have any experience, but I'm going to try to move towards that. And then you get
evidence-based,
and you're like, I'm doing evidence-based.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because there are guidelines and things that can help you, but until you start seeing patients, that's the art. Yeah. We always talk about the art of medicine. I liken this a lot to like a potions class, where you have to take a little tincture of this and a tincture of that, and the ingredients that you use and the recipe you come up with is so different depending on the patient that's sitting in front of you.
Right.
There's not like a black and white algorithm of like every person needs X, Y, and Z, and then they're going to feel better.
Right.
You know?
And people always ask me like, why don't I have an algorithm? And I'm like, listen, there are guidelines, but like an algorithm is great for like an urgent care where you have to go fast, right?
You have to
know what to do in a code. You need an algorithm of that. But when you're talking about someone's life functions, you know, preventative medicine, all the things that it's really precision-based. It has to be nuanced and it has to be based on that person in front of you, what their social determinants of health are, what all the
Absolutely.
Other guys, their family history, where they want to go with this. Like, you have to meet them where they are too. Like, we're not paternalistic people practicing paternalistic medicine. So,
right. And it's always hard because sometimes patients will say, like, what do you think I should do? You know, because they want someone to sort of tell them. And I'm like, I can't tell you what to do. I have to sort of help you along your path and your journey and really take a step back from that paternalistic way we used to think about medicine where we're like, well, this is what's best for you and this is what you should do.
Yeah.
You know? And I think sometimes they're used to being treated that way instead of being like, no, this is a shared decision-making conversation. Yeah. Like, you're an equal partner in what we're going to do. I'm not going to do anything that's unsafe, but within the safety confines, like, we've got to just figure out what's going to work for you. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I definitely do that. And I always, when I talk to patients sometimes, you know, you have to put yourself in their shoes sometimes. And that, I think, is part of being like a it actually like helps to reduce your bias and your implicit bias against the people in front of you because reflexivity in medicine is something that we should all be doing. And you can't do that in a 10-minute visit and, you know, but, you know, like I was telling you, I now have a concierge practice, talk to my patients and I'm like, okay, so you're our CEO of this. You have to take this transportation to get there. And then after there, you have to do this. Okay, in my mind, physical therapy is like on the bottom of your list, but I want you to have. So let's see how we can make this happen, you know? And so, really, it's taking that step to see how you show up for your patient just as much as what part of you shows up for them.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where the benefit of time comes in, right? Like you said, you have this concierge practice, so you have the ability to spend time with them to dig into their lives and figure out what are the barriers, you know, that are preventing them from accessing the care that we think that they need or that they deserve. And like, you can't get that in a 10-minute visit. Like, I can't practice in that kind of model where they're like, well, you have 10 minutes for a prenatal and 15 minutes for a GYN, you know, visit. And you're just like, what am I going to talk about in that time? I'm barely getting past, you know, tell me what brings you in the door, you know?
Yeah. What I think, you know, Amy, what I've been thinking about a lot, I did a podcast yesterday with Dr. Ami, but I don't know if you know her. She's at Harvard and she's a cardiologist. She's amazing.
Oh, cool.
she and I, like, because I have done a lot of deep research and sort of understanding of what happens in the AI world and how, you know, how disruptive it could be, but how helpful it could be. And she was like, you know, we have to think of it as like co-intelligence and stuff like that. And I had
really, interesting,
like, an enlightening, you know, discussion with her about it. And I get it because I was telling her some examples in my own office where I see patients who either like culturally or neurodivergently or other for one reason or another, like our cultural health capital is based on our best ability to communicate with our physician in front of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, whoever has the highest cultural health capital, meaning they're not, their body language is open enough for to receive a discussion, their ability to communicate words and know proper anatomical terms and all the things helps us better to get the answers. And so we were talking about how AI is like an adjunct, especially for those people who can't communicate their best.
Mm-hmm.
One reason or another, you know? And that's where I've seen people succeed with it. That's where I've seen people succeed with it. I think it's not a replacement by any means, but like as an adjunct,
no.
People the works.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it's interesting. So my husband is an AI guru, and I live in Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts and conflicted thoughts about it.
Me too.
And so we have some interesting, and then I have a 14-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old daughter. And so the 14-year-old daughter's
a 14-year-old and a 7-year-old.
And a 7, right? So we have similar ages, but that's AI is coming up in their
How
do you use it in school? And how don't you use it in school? And I think there are some really amazing tools in how do you think about it? How do we use it thoughtfully? And I like the idea of sort of the co-intelligence. Like they can't take over, you know, it can't take over the sort of the human thought process. Like you can't do a surgery, right? Yeah. And have AI do it because there's just things that are going to crop up and you know, that's a hands-on approach. And I think we can utilize those tools, but we have to be thoughtful for how we do it. But that's an interesting idea, right? With can patients communicate more effectively to us so we really understand what's going on with them and can we do it in a more effective and efficient
manner?
Right,
because if you only have 15 minutes and you did all this pre-work, well, maybe if I am effectively telling her or describing the pain the way it would make her think that it's meaningful, right? Or him think.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Half the time, you know, patients don't feel trusted in the system. And so they don't, you know, feel like maybe they can, especially, you know, women of color, Black women, they're not telling us everything because of the way they've been treated historically, right? And so a lot of times, you know, they're just, they're the difficult patient. No, actually, they're like, you know, guiding themselves, guarding themselves almost because of the way that,
They've been treated. Absolutely. I mean, it didn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, this is, you know, it's really, I think you're right. That could be a really interesting way to utilize that. What an interesting conversation you had yesterday.
Oh my God, it was really good. Yeah, I'll let you know when that one comes out because it was.
Oh, definitely.
And the other thing I have been thinking a lot about when it comes to some of this stuff is, you know, how perimenopause, you know, we're both on the OBGYN groups on Facebook you have all the OBGYNs that are, you know, and I get it because I used to be in a full academic practice where I saw OB and I'd see 30 to 40 patients a day and it gets very exhausting. And you hear other clinicians, OBGYNs, upset because of some of the information they see on social media and they bring it to you and they're angry, they're upset, they're this, they're that. And so, you know, and why are people turning to certain ulterior ways of getting treated? You know, all of those things that come up in my mind when I think about, you know, what the status of women's health is, right? We're one of the most predatory markets around, right?
Like, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Menopause is a multi-billion dollar market that will be, you know, even more growing in the future. So I think, you know, we have to address these things in a way that, you know, how is somebody using their Oura Ring to help figure out like their sleep pattern that might be, you know, an early sign of perimenopause? You know, some of these things we have to think.
But it's hard to think through it.
Period of time, right?
It is. It's really difficult. And what I find, and I think this has been talked about before, is, you know, how we have failed women in many ways. You know, it's a system that isn't designed to give you the time that you need to be with patients, but also as a society, we really haven't educated. I mean, we barely educate on puberty and contraception. We sure the hell haven't educated on what's happening in perimenopause, which I always liken as like you're stuck in puberty.
Forget about actual sex, like not just preventing STDs, but what happens with your sexual function, arousal mm-hmm. organ. Your clitoris is your pleasure organ.
Oh.
I mean, you know, this is the kind of stuff we talk about at Ishbush all day long, but like, it's something that is very like, you know.
Yeah. Just the lack of education. And I just had Dr. Julie Whitelaw on my podcast 2 days ago. We were just recording an episode about libido, and she's a sex therapist, and talked about how now the new like DSM-4 actually brings in like the partner skill set. Yeah. Like, is it really low libido if you're with a partner who can't provide pleasure? You know what I mean? You're like, well, is it low libido or is it just a bad lover? But I think that's so, but that comes from a lack of education. Like, we just don't talk about, like you said, we don't talk about the clitoris. We don't talk about the arousal cycle. We don't, you know, like you said, we talk about STDs and contraception, sort of, depending on where you live in the country. But other than that, you know, that's about it. Mm-hmm. And then you come to perimenopause and it is like just a wasteland. I mean, there's nothing out there.
Yeah.
And when there isn't anything there, people will come in to fill the space.
Yes.
And so that's where we're getting a lot of misinformation. And I have zero problem with physicians being on a social media platform to get education out. I think that is amazing. I think it's a way for us to do it. You have to. Mm-hmm. You have to tap into that communication tool. It's an easy way. It's an accessible way to get information out there. But it's also filled with folks who are, you know, sending out misinformation or, you know, kind of filling this void, or like you said, it's a predatory place. Like, oh, if you buy this particular thing, I promise you're going to feel better.
Yeah.
And it's because we are not in charge of the narrative, because there has been no narrative. We haven't done anything to help fill it. So other people are going to fill it for us. And that's partly why I got into doing the podcast that I do and why I wrote the book that I wrote, because Estrogen Interrupted is all about kind of what's happening in perimenopause. We have some really good books that have come out on menopause, which is awesome. I'm super happy about it.
Yeah.
But we don't have very many on perimenopause, and that's a different time. And so it's just hoping to get information out there. And as you said, you know, in your practice, it's like we see patients, but we can only see one person at a time.
Yeah.
And there's millions of people whose needs are not being met.
Yeah.
And so this is just, you know, hopefully just trying to close the gap a little bit in terms of
and you never know who will resonate with which book, right? Like, different people are going to like the style of somebody writing, you know, whatever, you know. And so
absolutely,
the more you read, the better, even though. So
the better. I mean, get evidence-based medicine out there, and then also, because there hasn't been a lot of research done on women in general, and not as much done in perimenopause and menopause.
We were allowed in research. You know, so.
I know. Yeah. I'm always like, and we have no data on that.
Yeah.
Then you have to fill in with expert opinion, or this is what we think we know.
Yeah.
This is where we really don't have this is our best guess on how to move forward with this while we wait for more information to come. And so just being honest with people about what we know, what we don't know, the limitations of the data that's out there, and then kind of helping them make the best, you know, educated guess for themselves, you know, educated decision for themselves. Yeah. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. I gave a very compelling, lecture to the Kellogg School at Northwestern, the business school. They asked me to come talk about, you know, the women's health market. And, you know, they're all in there like, they're like, let's hear about the women's health market. Where should we be going? And I really spun it in a way of them understanding, because, you know, I don't want more predators out there.
Right. Being like, this is a space. Let me fill it with, you know, some garbage that I'm going to decide you need.
I really like gave them a historical lens of, you know, okay, first of all, women's health is historically been very, very racist, right? Like, we have racist roots where, you know, slaves were being treated unanesthetized by Marion Sims as an example, you know. And I was telling them about the roots of sexism and how, you know, everything was hysteria until it wasn't, you know. And the fact that we still say hysterectomy, like, we need a name change.
But, we need a rebrand. Just like PCOS had a recent rebrand, we need a rebrand.
I gave them all of this information that I talked about with WHI. And I said, you know, the reality is what's happened in women's health is that women no longer, because of the chronic dismissal, like, women no longer trust their physicians. They don't trust the same person that told them to relax and have a glass of wine for their sex pain. But, you know what I'm saying? Which,
yes.
One out of five women with vulvovaginal disease have been told that. Which is, you know, one out of five.
Appalling.
I mean, I hear it every day in my office because I treat so much sexual pain. But
that is like, appalling.
How do we rebuild this trust? You know, you and I are doctors. We're in this space. We're evidence-based. But I feel like, you know, the problem is this industry is booming, which is great for some people, I guess. And it's not a problem, but it is a problem when we start harming the patients that should, yeah, that don't know any better. And so now we're in a situation where we've had centuries of mistrust, you know, that has evolved into an empty space that's getting filled with, you know, wellness this, wellness that,
longevity,
gummies that, you know. And yep. So, you know, where should we go? I mean, that's why I'm on social media. And that's why I'm podcasting, probably the same for you. But what else can we do? We need women to trust us again.
I know. And how do you, I don't know how you do that. I mean, it's, you do your best, but it's hard. I mean, one of the big things I see in perimenopause all the time is by the time patients will come see me, they're so mad at the doctors that they saw before. They're so angry. And they'll be like, they just wanted to give me birth control pills. They weren't listening.
Yeah.
And so one of the episodes on my podcast that's actually ended up being one of our more popular ones is about contraception versus hormone therapy and why you choose one versus the other. Yeah. And I talk a lot about, I'm like, I don't think your doctor necessarily was dismissing you. They may not have been explaining to you why this was a good choice.
Exactly.
And because they have 10 minutes.
Yeah, and they also, like, that's what the answer to everyone's problems has always been. Oh, you think you have pelvic pain? Try birth control pills. Oh, you're not getting your cycle because you have PCOS? Try birth control pills. So, like, you know, people think of it as just, like, our reflex as opposed to saying this is actually a treatment for this medication because of the way it works, right?
Right, exactly. And then you're also trying to, you know, but they have all of their girlfriends and their mothers and their aunties and their family members who have been like, if the doctor tells you to do this, they don't know what they're talking about because they've had terrible experiences. So you're like, basically, you're already behind by the time you even walk in the door because they are bringing in all of, you know, their shared traumas or experiences and preconceived notions of what needs to happen. And so it takes time to build that trust. And
We need a rebranding, OBGYN specifically, not all physicians, maybe some primary cares, but especially all I see is, well, my OBGYN did this. And then you hear other doctors saying, well, those OBGYNs out there are doing, do you know how I'm saying? Well,
we get it from all sides. I mean, we really do because we have the birth stories, right? So the kind of this idea, like all about how your pregnancy is supposed to go and how your delivery is supposed to go. And it's Mother Nature. Like, we can't predict what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so people are disappointed about that, right? Because it is a medicalized experience in your life, but that a lot of people don't want to be medicalized. But unfortunately,
life-saving endeavors, or else, you know.
Right. I'm like, well, you know, we're trying to really work on maternal mortality rates. And then we get it from, you know, that group. And then we get it from other doctors who basically, and, you know, and then the parents, sorry, I'll go back to the patients. So patients are upset about their birth story. Then they're upset about their pain being dismissed and ignored forever, right? Endometriosis, how long it takes to diagnose it. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. And then you get into perimenopause and menopause, and that's just a whole cluster. But then we get it from our colleagues. I mean, we get it from our surgery colleagues who think we're terrible surgeons. Like, oh, they don't know how to operate. I mean, they're afraid of ovaries. They take one look at an ovary and they scream. But sure, we don't know anything.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
never in a topic with a belly full of blood.
Right. I mean, how many people have you and I saved in our lives? I mean, a lot. We've saved a lot of people. Literally, I'm not just being dramatic about that.
And
but
babies. We've saved a lot of babies.
A lot of babies. We've saved a lot of mamas. We've saved a lot of babies. And, you know, but we get it. We get it from those colleagues. We get it from, you know, primary care colleagues who are like mad because we put somebody on hormone replacement therapy because they think they shouldn't be on it. But we know the data so much more deeply than they do. But they are from the era of the WHI study and hormones are terrible and bad. So it's like mistrust within our system, within our colleagues. And then we have mistrust from the public. And we're kind of just like, we're in a little bit of a, like, we can't win. I mean, I think you and I are both on some OBGYN Facebook groups, but there's other physician Facebook groups that have a variety of different people coming from different subspecialties and subspecialties. The OBGYN bashing on those is horrible.
Horrible. It makes me sad, actually. And I mean, I'm just like, just imagine for 1 minute that you're seeing 30 patients a day and one of them goes into labor and you have to leave and then you have to come, you know, like they don't even have an understanding of the scope of what a general OBGYN in a town that doesn't have many would have to do. And it makes me really mad. I think we, like, I've lived that life for a short time. You know, I was, it's never in sort of a small, but I've lived the life of being an OBGYN.
Of a generalist,
Of a generalist. And
I mean, you're up all night. You're trying to keep people alive. You're doing your best. I mean, you're really in, I mean, I look back at my residency and, you know, I have very positive experiences about the type of training that I received and how grateful I am for that. But it was a war zone at times. I mean, you're just, you know, you're traumatized and you think about all those people's lives that you've saved. But then there's like the one thing that maybe you didn't do perfectly, but people fixate on that. And they're like, but you did this. And I'm like, look at all these other things that I really put my heart and soul into. And it's a disheartening time.
I think we trained at around the same time when, I mean, the 80-hour work week was just starting when I was like,
brand new.
And it was kind of like not really implemented.
I mean, that's hilarious.
And it was always like, well, this is not how we learned it. And it's so funny. I also had someone on a podcast who's a coach for intergenerational workplace navigating intergenerational workplaces and how to understand Gen Z. And she was telling me all the time, she's like, you know, I was like, well, let me give you an example. If I was in an academic setting and I thought a resident was lazy because she was da-da-da, and she was like, see, that resident is going to, she was just describing the typical Gen Z to me and that millennials and all the things. And so it really is an understanding of, you know, the cultural environment that they were also raised in and how you have to be more gingerly now, like, you know?
Yeah. You have to be more sensitive. You know, sometimes that's hard because I just want to be like, dude, you gotta pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Like, let's get your big girl pants on. Let's go. Yeah. And then other times you're like, well, just because I was treated that way,
I know.
Like there are things that need to change. Right. And so it's an interesting, and I feel like we're a little bit in that generation of sort of between the two, because there's colleagues of mine who are, you know, a decade older, two decades older. And they're just like, I don't have time for that.
They don't even entertain it. Yeah.
Nope. They're like, I'm not engaging. You know, the other thing that I think is hard, and you've been in private practice, now you're in a concierge model, you've been in an academic setting, is when we think about, I mean, people always think about doctors and like, oh, you're a doctor, you're rich, which I just am like, no, that's not, and not that anybody's going to feel bad for us, but like, we're not. And we think about like what we're reimbursed for taking care of from an insurance perspective, what we are reimbursed for taking care of someone through their pregnancy and their delivery, which is so many things can go wrong.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. And
doesn't even account for the amount of hours that you're in the hospital, the postpartum care that you get, the postpartum in the office. Like, people, it's bundled. It's a bundled rate of like.
And it's not great. And when I look at insurance companies, when you look at procedures, and you probably know this more intimately than I do, when you look at procedures, like if it's the same procedure that's being done on a male patient and a female patient, kind of depending on who does the procedure, it's reimbursed at different rates, which is bullshit, right?
Misogyny.
Absolute. It's such misogyny. Like, why do we devalue ourselves so much that we take pennies on the dollar compared to our male colleagues for the same procedure that we're both performing? Like, what happened?
It's so crazy.
You know,
also how we, I think, as women have always been whether acculturated to, you know, or whatever, because I think that, you know, you can, like, we don't know how to learn to negotiate contracts, right? Like, we don't
know.
Like, it's so funny because I was talking to my husband, who's an interventional pain doctor, and he's hired different people along the way. And it was interesting to me, like, when he hired a woman versus a man. And I'd always point this out to him. He was like, the baseline salary would start out similar, but the woman would accept it.
Yep.
You know, because we
and
don't
the men, make an argument. Yeah.
The guys would be like, I think I deserve blah, 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 plus blah, 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 plus a bonus structure. And so I was like, dude, what the hell? He's like, well, I'm not going to argue with someone that, you know, that doesn't want to argue with their own, you know?
If they're not going to negotiate, then great. If I can get them for cheaper.
Then what am I going to do? You know, I'm still running a business. And I was you know?
But it's terrible.
Like, I was basically saying, give her more because she's a what?
Right. And he's like, well, she didn't ask for it, so I'm not going to.
For it, right? Like, she didn't ask for it. Also, like, you know, like, we have to run a business. So if you can, you know.
If you can get somebody for cheaper and get the same quality of work, you know, as a business owner, you'll do it, right? But women have to learn that we deserve more and we should ask for what's fair. I mean, I had a conversation with a colleague and I was really angry about sort of the pay disparity that was happening. And she said to me, well, don't you think you make enough? And I said, it isn't about whether I make enough. It's about that it's fair and that I make the same. I deserve to be paid the same as a male colleague doing the exact same thing. And it's bullshit that I'm not. And we have a little bit of this, like you kind of go into medicine because you want to make the world a better place. That's great. But we're just perpetuating our own cycle. Like we're just perpetuating this. Yeah. And it's like sometimes we're so grateful to have a seat at the table that we're happy to take a seat at the kiddie table rather than at the adult table at Thanksgiving. Like, I don't want to be at the kiddie table.
Yeah,
I worked my ass off. I deserve to be over here and be recognized for what I'm bringing, you know, what my expertise is.
It's so true. And I was on this podcast, Taboo Truth, last month. And the person asked me, she's like, you talk a lot about health equity. And this is a talk I give a lot. And she goes, you know, but you are a concierge doctor now. And I was like, yeah. I said, absolutely. I said, I gave probably 11 years to private practice where I did not collect probably 40% of what I made. I did not go after patients for those payments. I lived in, you know, like in a debt situation in terms of what I was getting, you know, like this is the only way for me to practice medicine the way it should be, the way the patients are heard, the way, you know, that I can support this practice and actually earn a living, you know, versus like, you know, I'm not saying I want to like be a multimillionaire. You know what I'm saying? I want
to you need to be able to pay your overhead. You need to make a living after that. And you deserve that. Like any other white man would walk in and there wouldn't be a question of it.
Not even a question.
But we, not one question, not even a blink. I mean, I have a colleague who was working at an academic institution and she was renegotiating her salary. And she was a single mom. She had two kids, single mom. And she said, you're paying male colleague this and I deserve to be paid the same. And the response to her was, well, they're the breadwinner for their family, so they deserve to get paid more. Literally the direct words. Wow. Not at my institution, it was a different institution, but unbelievable. And this was in 2000s. Like this was not like in 1982 where they were like, well, you're taking a job from a man, so you better be happy with what you got, you know? Yeah. I mean, and she's like, I'm sorry, I'm paying for my family. I mean, you could, but this was like total mental mindset. Like, yeah, no, this is it.
I mean, that's the bias that exists, right?
Across the board. Exactly.
Systemic problems that we have to deal with. And it can be very maddening. I mean, the same podcast I was telling about, there was this comment that was like, well, doctors are so greedy. And I was like, what? I hate that rhetoric. And I was like going in there and I was like, you know, doctors are allowed to get compensated for the time, effort, and their experience. Just like a lawyer does. Just like a construction person. You know, whatever it is. You know? Like
exactly.
My plumber was making more an hour than I was when I was in.
Oh, no, my kids' tutors do. I mean, you know, it's like, this is it. I mean, my husband's a lawyer. He bills by like the 30-second increment and I'm over here just working for free. And it's frustrating. And with the advent of the electronic medical record, we are expected to do more and more work for the same amount of money. So patients are like, well, you didn't get back to me I sent you an email. I don't get paid to do patient emails.
Yeah.
That is not. That's just considered part of the job. But it's a half day a week.
Yeah.
I mean, at least it's 4 hours. At minimum, I am emailing patients 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
Minimum. And not getting paid for that time because it's done on the weekends and the evenings and it's unseen labor and it's this sort of easy access. And I think it's really hard too because doctors were providing what is considered to be a fundamental human right, right? The right to healthcare.
Yeah.
And so there's this thought that we shouldn't be compensated for our time. And it's a broken system, right? The insurance company, because they're like, well, I'm paying for insurance. Why do I have to pay a copay? I'm paying for insurance. Why do I have to
pay us? Okay.
Yeah. But that insurance doesn't pay us. Yeah. They'll do anything they can not to pay us.
Yeah.
It's
totally broken. I say this almost every episode. We have a broken system. It's broken for doctors and it's broken for the women that need the most help.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's very discouraging. Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, you just have to like, there's this really interesting, on the podcast, it was on Wednesday, talking about the Jenga pieces of life and how sometimes you just need to let it all fall to the ground and rebuild.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know, maybe we need a Jenga healthcare. Jenga. And figure out how to like rebuild it so people are getting their needs met.
It's on the verge of Jenga. So.
It is. We're gonna Jenga it, and then we're gonna figure it out and yeah. find a way that everybody's getting their needs met, right? Yeah. And that's shouldn't be that hard. Yet here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
I know.
And I think the women that struggle the most are the most vulnerable, or you know, obviously women of color. They're the ones full of vaginal pain that's been dismissed.
Oh, here. Ignored.
The perimenopausal, menopausal women who are just like, you know, half the time just told to suffer and live through it. But, you know, we're here. So we're gonna switch it to positive.
Yeah, we're switching to positive. That was our therapy. Welcome to our therapy.
That was our therapy session. We needed to do that for each other.
You're like, we're not alone. We're not crazy.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah. Like, offline, I'll tell you what I've been experiencing for those 10 days. It's been awful. But anyway, I want to talk to you also about, perimenopause. What's your best way of going about treating patients? Like, a patient comes in, not with the typical complaints. They're like, the big one, NFLM. I just don't feel like myself.
Yep.
I can't put my fingers on it. I'm more anxious than I used to be. This is every single patient we see, bro.
Yeah, everyone. I just don't feel like myself.
Mm-hmm. Don't feel like myself. So talk to me how you would talk to that patient.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I'm grateful for the practice model I have, because I do have time. And so I have to, when they come in, I basically say, tell me everything, leave nothing out, even if you think it's not related. And they'll usually talk nonstop for at least 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then this happened, and then this happened, and then, you know, and they might go back 10 years. Yeah. They're 48, but like, well, when I was 38, these things I started noticing.
Yeah.
So I let them get everything out.
Those are important pieces of the puzzle.
Those are the key pieces, because I figure out what is the most, maybe they can't put it into a concrete description, but what is the top 3 to 5 symptoms that are really impacting their quality of life? What is throwing them off so they don't feel like themselves? And often it's, like you said, it's the invisible things, because we talk a lot about hot flashes and irregular bleeding and all of those things. And absolutely, those are sort of hallmark symptoms of perimenopause. But the other ones, the anxiety, the sleep, the new onset, panic attacks, maybe a worsening of their depression, joint pain, they're just stiff, they feel tired, they're fatigued, they hate their partner, they're grouchy, they're irritable, they hate their kids.
They're angry.
Mad at their parents. They're just angry. They're so angry. And so I let them sort of launch into everything. And then I obviously validate. I'm like, you're hitting all the punch lists. This is very typical.
Do you watch My Friends and Neighbors, by the way?
No, you are the second person who's told me in the last 24 hours that I need to watch Your Friends and Neighbors. Yeah, so clearly
really
I need to get on
she's
this.
She's really good, first of all. And second of all, she's going through perimenopause. She's so angry. I'm like,
so angry. These patients are so mad. I think back as I'm of the age.
Angry. I'm in the middle of it. I'm so angry all the time.
I'm so angry. I mean, I know how to treat myself, and I'm still just like breathing real deep so I don't punch my poor lovely husband, you know, who's like, I just walked in the room. What did I do?
What do you have? You have a problem? Am I chewing that much? Because I'm just looking at him. I'm like,
I know. I'm like, why do you have to breathe? Why are you breathing so loud? Like, stop it. You know, and you're just like, oh my God, I am unhinged over here.
That's how I felt. I felt unhinged the other day.
So unhinged. And I talk about why. Why is this happening? So we dig into the physiology. What is going on with our hormones? You may still be having regular, predictable menstrual cycles, but that doesn't mean you're not having hormonal fluctuations where things are a little bananas. They're going up and down. They're kind of chaotic and crazy. Our brain doesn't like that. Our brain does not like when hormones aren't in their nice, beautiful, predictable pattern. It throws things off. So I explain the physiology. I'm like, there's nothing that you can do to make that different other than we can talk about therapeutic options, but you can't will it away. You know, you can't be like, oh, don't do that, ovary and brain, like get in line.
Yeah.
And then I talk a lot about sort of the social construct of where you're at in your life and why things are coming to roost now.
Yeah.
Like, you used to be able to get away with 5 hours of sleep. We can't do that anymore. Or your terrible sleep hygiene. So you've been like, oh, it's fine. You know, I can get through it. But you're like, no, all of those things are catching up with you. Mm-hmm. Sort of I think of the Ed Sheeran song, Our Bad Habits. And the sort of, I've always, this is the big one. I haven't changed a thing about how I eat or exercise, but I'm gaining weight. And saying, we have to mix things up. We're in a transition. Just like with puberty, we're transitioning. We're in this transition and we have to figure out what's the new way for our body to move and groove, you know, the new way to make us feel like our best selves, and a reframing of, we're not going to feel like we did when we were 25 or 30. We're older.
Yeah.
And it's hard. And that's hard to be like, but I'm kind of creaky when I wake up and like my face is like melting down. Like my skin is just like a saggy mess. And so reframing that these things are normal. They're supposed to be happening. There's nothing pathologically wrong with you. Assuming we've ruled out, you know, other causes of that can mimic these symptoms. And then we say we need to live the best version of ourselves for who we're at right now and try to let go of the person we were at 30, which is really difficult. And I think we talked about this. We actually talked about this with the low libido episode that's going to come out about where our sex life might look different than it did when we were 19 or 25 or 30. That doesn't mean it's wrong. And we can mourn the loss of that. Like, and that's okay to grieve that, to be like, oh, I wish things were still like that. And then kind of reframing into the reality of where are we at now and what tools do we have in our toolbox to make ourselves feel better with who we are at this moment.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my general like gestalt of how I approach it. What do you do when you see patients?
I mean,
is this similar?
Very similar to what I do. I, you know, really get a sense of what are the biggest things that are like in, like, what are the biggest reasons they don't feel like themselves, you know?
Yeah.
This ruminating thoughts I have all the time. It's the fact that like I've gained 5 pounds and I can't fit the clothes that I want anymore. You know, it's the fact that I'm hot all the time, you know, whatever, my muscles are aching, and then really getting into it and then talking to them about the physiology. Some of them do come in with this horrible libido and difficulty with sex and orgasms, and, you know, really for them to understand what is a normal sexual response cycle for a woman in a long-term relationship is not you see your husband and you're hot and horny for them. No,
right.
It's a response of desire, right? Like, you need to be aroused first. You need to look at him in his outfit that he's cleaning your bathroom for you, and all of a sudden you're more attracted to him because he's doing chores. We call that chore play for a reason. Like,
chore play.
Yeah. It's like just like those memes that go around where you have like a man that's shirtless carrying a baby and holding a vacuum and doing dishes at the same time.
Yes, exactly.
Is this porn for women? Yes,
it absolutely is.
Because
mom porn.
There's something huge about how heteronormative roles in relationships have such a negative impact on your sex life. You know, if you're the one that's also working till 5 every day and you come home and your husband's on the couch because he was working till 5, but you got to go take the kids here, and make dinner, you're like, what the hell? This is bullshit.
It is bullshit. Like, who signed up for this? This isn't what we were promised.
Yeah,
you know, women can have it all. Well, yeah, if you break your own back in the process of doing
exactly.
You know, your husbands are just like, oh, I got to go work out. I've been at work all day. I'm exhausted. Yeah. I got to get the stress off. And I'm like, I'm literally like covered. Covered in like applesauce and chicken nuggets, you know, when my kids were little. And you're just like, what do you think I've been doing all day? Yeah. You know?
I want that too. So, yeah.
So,
and then,
yeah.
Sometimes it is just like, and I have my good sex therapist friend, Lori Mitz, who always says sometimes she's in a therapy session telling people that they need to separate their chores. Like, you after school will do this and this, and it makes their lives better. And then they want to go have sex, you know? And
so exactly.
So that makes it, there's less resentment. But I think when
I love that.
Well, you know, they understand that responsive desire. And I love it when their husbands come in too, and you're just like, you got to understand the whole thing and how it works. And, oh, yeah, if I have pain, I'm not going to want to have sex. Or, yeah, sure, those SSRI messed up my arousal. Like, all the things, right? So
all the things. Yep. And it's really complicated. And that's where, again, the tincture of time, I think, in education is so helpful. And bringing in those team members, because I'm not a sex therapist. You know, I don't have a therapy background. But who are my people that I can bring in to help patients? Like, I sort of view myself as the quarterback of the perimenopausal team.
Yes.
I've got. And you have to dig in. You have to dig in to their sleep.
Yes.
Like, what is happening? because you can't survive on crappy sleep. You're going to feel awful. Everything is worse when you haven't had a decent night's sleep. And how many of these people come in, they're like, I really haven't slept since I had my kids.
Yeah.
Like, well, your children are in college.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
what is happening?
It's happening.
Like, this is not okay. And I'll say, I need you to see a sleep specialist. And they'll be like, I don't have sleep apnea. I'm like, first of all, you might, and you may not know it because women are underdiagnosed and, and it becomes more prevalent at this time frame, but for a variety of reasons. But there's other underlying sleep things, and we need to get you into sort of potentially cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And they're like, I don't want to do that. I'm like, it is the biggest bang for your buck. And once you're sleeping, you don't want to kill everybody around you. You know, but the anxiety is
when I fell asleep last night, or when you were still doing OB, like, this is one of the reasons, because I was OB hospitals. My husband's like, you need to start a practice where you can control your life because you've become a different person.
Oh.
I was like, yeah, because I've been working 6 weeks of nights in a row, you know?
And it's horrible. Like, it's just you're up all night and you are bone tired. And if you think about carrying that for decades, oh no. And then you put your hormonal, crazy hormonal fluctuations of perimenopause on there.
Like, just go ahead.
You're like, I'm out. Like, this is just a mess. And the anxiety, I mean, you mentioned sort of this like crippling anxiety, or people will perseverate on something. They'll wake up at 3 a.m. and they're thinking about something that is not an emergency, but feels like it at the time. Mm-hmm. New onset panic attacks. That's rough. That is real. And you're just like, I feel I'm having like an out-of-body experience, like I'm not in control of myself.
Yeah.
And that feels very disconcerting to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're really validating. You just have to validate, like, yes, exactly. Yes,
I think it's very. And then they're asking, is everything perimenopause then? And I'm like, well, a lot of it is, but a lot of it is your life. And it's the collision. It's a collision course.
And it's hard to tease those apart, right? Because if your lifestyle isn't, if your life isn't changing, you're not. Like, it's can be hard to tease them apart, but sometimes you don't really have to tease them apart. You just have to figure out how you're going to treat them as a whole.
Yeah.
But we can't blame hormones for everything. You just can't. Like, there are other things that are going on. Like I said, all of the various dysfunctions in your life that are coming up that you used to be able to, compensate for. And now you can't compensate anymore because you're just out of compensation. You're just like, I can't handle all these balls in the air anymore. Yeah. It's too much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then how do you usually treat some of these patients? Do you go straight to hormone therapy? Do you give them?
I talk a lot about hormone therapy. I certainly go into, I'll get into hormones in a moment because that's a big piece. But I have, like I said, all my players on my team. So we talk about sleep. We talk about your relationship and sort of the quality of your relationship. And this might be a time to address some of the maybe disparities in your relationship with your partner, or is this still the same partner that I want to have, or can I make things better with them? So we talk a lot about that. I talk about sort of nutrition. We talk about exercise and sort of this idea that we have to kind of get away from the focus on just cardio and really get into the strength training for our body composition. I talk a lot about how your workouts are going to change and they're going to look different because now we're all about function. Kind of motion is lotion. We want to keep those... Yeah. Keep those joints lubricated, keep that body moving. I do a lot of Pilates. When I was 30, I'd be like, what are you people doing in there? Now I'm like, I need to be able to bend over and pick something off the floor.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm doing because my focus is different. And then I'll get into hormones. And I talk a lot about, I kind of have three categories that I'll get into. And I talk about sort of non-hormonal therapies, of course. Like if someone's having debilitating depression or anxiety, we can talk about, do we want to use a medication that's more tailored for that. But hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone therapy or hormone therapy in general can be helpful for depression and anxiety because you're getting to that underlying basis of these crazy hormonal fluctuations, right? So the three categories I talk about are birth control pills. Again, one, we have to talk about contraception. What are your contraceptive desires at this moment? Do you need to be contracepting?
Yeah.
So we talk about that. But I also talk about contraception because what happens with hormonal, with most combined hormonal contraceptives, which are your typical usually your birth control pills, your birth control patches, your birth control, the NuvaRing, they suppress ovulation. So they are hormonal suppressives. And so then you're not having the erratic hormones that are there. And so when I really get into that, and I'm drawing pictures, yeah. I'll show them loop cycles. The whole thing. I'm like, this is why this medication can work so yeah. incredibly well. Not only are you going to regulate your periods if your periods are crazy and heavy, yeah. but we can get that crazy hormonal fluctuations to calm down, kind of flatten the curve, so to speak, on those so that you're not having such highs and lows, which can be so helpful, right? So we talk about that. I also talk about how in the combined hormonal contraceptives, the type of estrogen that's in there is an estrogen called ethinyl estradiol. And that works at the estrogen receptor a little bit differently than estradiol, which is what our ovary makes. And so ethinyl estradiol is great to help control bleeding. Like that's why it's part of these combined hormonal contraceptives, but doesn't always do a great job with perimenopausal symptoms. So if you're somebody who's on a birth control pill, but you're having breakthrough perimenopausal symptoms, I'm like, oh, it's probably time for us to change up the formulation. And then I can either go to menopausal hormone therapy, which could work if they don't need contraception, because menopausal hormone therapy does not prevent pregnancy. Or I do a combination of estradiol, which is what the predominant estrogen that's the most popular now that people use in menopausal hormone therapy. And I combine it with a progestin-only birth control, and we put the two of them together. So, yeah. And one of my favorites now is the use of the oral drospirenone, or the trade name is Slynd. Yeah. I love it, right? Because you're suppressing ovulation, but then you get your estrogen from a different source. Yeah. And then you kind of are treating both things. So that's one of my favorites. It's what I'm personally on. I'm like, I love that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also love
really good progestin sensitivity or progesterone sensitivity, or they have they're more erratic bleeding on OMP. You know, just like shove it all down and just give you what you need.
Just give you what you need. I was having a lot of migraines because of the hormonal fluctuation. So it was great because it sort of calmed all of that down. And then I could treat my night sweats and my other stuff with an estradiol. And I love the use of an IUD with this. I love, the leave-in progesterone containing IUDs. They don't suppress ovulation, so you're still going to have some of those hormonal swings. But, often if you can add estradiol on top of it in whatever way, shape, or form, you can get to a place where you're feeling pretty steady. So that's sort of my general gestalt when somebody comes in and they want to talk about hormonal options. Then those are sort of the three buckets that I kind of talk about.
Agreed. And how do you feel about testosterone? I have to ask.
I think testosterone has a place in terms of, for me, I use it in my practice for low libido, so hypoactive sexual desire disorder. I think there's a lot of claims online that testosterone is sort of the new fountain of youth, like the new vitality longevity medication. And there's a lot of claims out there about what testosterone is going to do for you, with not a lot of data behind that. Or we do have data and we're like, oh, actually it doesn't really work for that. Yeah. So I don't use it because people will come in and they're like, but I need to have testosterone. I'm like, well, how's your libido? Oh, my libido is fine. I don't have any problems with my libido. I'm like, for my practice, I don't throw it in routinely. I tell folks, I'm like, for me, I worry that if you're using it for vitality purposes, like you want to put on muscle, you want to have more energy, I worry about the doses that you need in order to achieve those effects. And now we're getting into
much higher than the pre-med.
Yeah, exactly. And then I worry about side effects for those, which are, not reversible. So, but I know that's all over social media right now. And so I try to say, well, I know there's a lot of claims out there, but we don't have a lot to, I personally am much more sort of, I don't want to say restrictive, but much more careful with my use of that, just because you need to make sure that you're not getting yourself into trouble.
Right. Right. And I think, part of what's so hard about hormones is, because it's so different for everyone, because, I think we don't know the status of everyone's receptor at that organ, right? Like it really comes down to that lock and key that you learn about way back in the day with the receptor and the hormone. And like how it's going to interact, right? Like, is it going to cause me to like really a small amount do really well for me? Or am I going to have to like push the limit for that part of my body to get the most bang for their buck? And then mm-hmm. the other side effects are going to be whatever, you know? So, yeah. I mean, that I think is the problem that we have in terms of why some people get benefits with lower doses. And, you know, obviously we know there's a magical placebo effect for so many things, but
right.
some people get benefit from smaller doses and other people need much larger to feel anything. And, you know, testosterone, like all the sex med drugs are like 50 to 60%, right? Nothing's a dart.
A sure thing. Nothing is a sure thing. And I tell them like 50-50, this is going to help.
Yeah.
So
you know, I feel like, you know, let's try it in the right way.
Absolutely. If we're going to try it, let's try it. And then we reevaluate. We make sure that for you, you're not a hyper responder, you know, where you have like your levels are getting really high. Check your side effects, see how you're feeling. And if we're not seeing anything, then we can say, well, this isn't maybe necessarily, you're not needed for your sort of potions class.
Right.
Your little tincture of all the things that we're putting together. But oh, it's big. Everybody wants testosterone right now.
Yeah.
It's like it's having a moment. And there's a little part of me that's sort of like, haven't we been there with these hormones? Like I feel the cycle keeps coming with like feminine forever in the 60s. And then it was like, oh, wait, maybe we need to add some progestogen to this because it's going to cause uterine cancer. Oh, wait, maybe this causes breast cancer. Oh, wait. And then it's like comes back. We're like, no, everyone needs to be on estrogen or testosterone or whatever it is. And you're like, not everybody needs everything. And every person is so different. So you really have to tailor it to the person who's in front of you. But I feel like we're on this like upswing of like, hormones are going to fix and change everything.
Yeah. And there's some of my patients that come in and I'm
the phone.
Yeah. Why do you want to be on the, is there some, like, cause your symptoms all sound, we can do a DEXA that we can see what your bone health is. I'm not going to say, I'm not going to give it to you, but I'm just wondering where you're at. She's like, I have so much FOMO.
And I'll much FOMO.
Oh, well, FOMO's not enough. I gotta say, I'm not going to keep it here for you, but it's hard to understand what it can and can't do.
Exactly. The promises that are being made, the promises are very, if someone's promising you the moon, you have to be very wary about that, right?
Maybe Oprah did see color for the first time when she had hormones because she was in such a dark place before, right? Like, but you're coming from a different place. You didn't have those hot flashes, night sweats, vasomotor, sleep disturbance, That wasn't for you. So what, is it going to help you? Probably will help your bones for sure. We can say that.
Yeah. We can say that. So I get a lot of, bone scans. I do it early than the recommended age 65 because it's part of my algorithm of, you know, when somebody's on the fence and they're like, I don't know, should I be on it? Should I not?
Maybe
we're wrestling with a couple of things that can become kind of part of our decision-making tree of like, does this seem like it's going to be helpful for you or not? But, the FOMO. And I get a lot. Are you getting a lot of patients like, the poor patients who like missed the window because of the WHI. And now they're like late 60s and I'm like, but I want to be on hormones. I'm like, because they just want to be on hormones. Like they think they need it for their longevity. And you're like, it's going to be okay.
I mean, I'll entertain anyone's ideas and we'll talk about it. Right. Like just, I will.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. You just have to have the conversation, but you're like you said, you have to be very honest about what this is going to do for you.
Yeah.
What's in the, what are the realistic? So we have realistic expectations because I don't want to tell somebody like, I'm going to put you on this and suddenly like your whole life is going to improve.
Yeah.
You know, because hormones are not going to treat, a challenging marriage or a dissatisfying job or, the kids and the sandwich generation of taking care of your kids and your parents and being squished and hormones aren't going to give you more hours in your day.
Yeah.
It's so you have to be realistic.
Too, where like I have patients who come to me like they want to try like Addy or whatever. My last doctor wouldn't give it to me because he told me that I'd want sex all the time. And I'm like, no, that's not how this works either. Let's get realistic here. You might not reject
Right, exactly.
Five times out of the month. You might only reject them two times out of the month.
Out of the month, right, exactly. This is not going to turn you into like a horn bot, I promise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so having some of that, and I think there's also like so much frustration with patients, right? Because men get Viagra and Cialis and all the things, and they just like have this immediate response and everything. Like they can start to feel a little bit more like they did when they were younger.
Actually, I have patients who are like, that does nothing for my husband.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally, right? Doesn't work for everybody.
That's the marketing.
It's the marketing. Exactly. It's this perceived what this is going to do for me. Yes. And so they're mad that we don't have a version of that for them. And I get that. It's frustrating. And I also get, you know, their frustration where like their husband's Viagra is covered by insurance, but their vaginal estrogen isn't. And they're like, well, what would you like him to do with this Viagra situation that you've now created? Because
don't put it here.
Don't. This is a do not enter zone if I don't have my vaginal estrogen, right?
Really appreciate you being on today. This has been wonderful. I know we did a little bit of a bitch session, guys. Sorry about that. But we were facing our realities of how we practice medicine in this country. So it's just the truth. Some people need to hear it.
Got to hear it. But, you know, but really, we love our jobs. We love taking care of our patients. That's why we do what we do. 100%. And I have a lot of hope. Like, I love the fact that these conversations are forefront, that we're being honest about it. I love that perimenopause and menopause are having a moment.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to be here for it and just be part of trying to get, you know, information out there for patients to be able to choose the right path for them. So it is really a time of some great hope as well. So
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.
When is your book coming out?
June 16th. Yep. Oh, it drops in.
Wow. Forget it.
So June 16th, it is available all places where you buy your books online and will be available.
Anything? We're going around the place.
We have a couple of events. Yeah. So we're doing an event at Virginia Commonwealth University at their big women's health education event that they do, that the university does, which will be really fun. Mm-hmm. And then we're doing some, we're going to Seattle. We're going to be in Santa Rosa, California. And then we're working on getting a few more events going. And then now, I guess the newest thing is you are on people's podcasts, and that's how you talk about your book as well, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And our hope is just to be a great reference guide, an honest reference guide for women, so they can pick it up and be like, okay, I'm having hot flashes. What's happening? And they can go to the hot flash chapter and be like, oh, okay, this is what's going on, you know?
Well,
so, yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks so much, Amy. Take care. Remember, thanks everyone for listening. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me.
Have a second. Please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for GynoGirl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is GynoGirl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, GynoGirl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, GynoGirl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.